First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Defending the city of Jacksonville and its people from the impacts of climate change. Good morning. Live with you from Studio 2, I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, Jacksonville's Chief Resilience Officer stops by, fills us in on what she's been doing since she first came to town, and lets us in on her plans for the future and how you can get involved. You can join us right now at 549-2937. Then later, honoring International Holocaust Remembrance Day later this week. How the First Coast remembers. That and more ahead. But first this hour, since she first came to Jacksonville in 2021, Ann Colianese, the city's chief resilience officer, has been in fact-finding mode, getting to know her new home and the threats facing it. Now she's sharing what the data shows so far as she prepares for a series of public meetings to help shape the city's resilience strategy. In addition, Jacksonville is hiring a firm to help evaluate its land development regulations, which Ann says could reveal new opportunities to address climate-related threats. So much to discuss. We're pleased to welcome back to the show Ann Colianese, Chief Resilience Officer for the City of Jacksonville. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
And as we talk about Jacksonville becoming a more resilient city, we want to hear from you, everyone. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Facebook already getting your comments. So you became the city's first ever chief resilience officer when you were hired in 2021. And what have you been up to since you came to town?
We've been really focused on gathering comprehensive data sets to really drive all of our long-term planning. I was fortunate when I started that a lot of conversations had already begun, both in City Hall and city different departments. The planning department held its adaptation action area working group. The public works department had its own working group looking at resilience. And then, of course, in council and throughout the community, there were conversations going on. So really, there was a lot of theory about the direction that residents and public officials wanted Jacksonville to take. But what we were really missing was some of the data to bring a level of objectivity to that planning process. And so for the better part of the last year, we have been gathering very savvy data sets specifically on flooding and heat. Mm-hmm. And flooding is kind of a catch-all term that we hear a lot. But it's important, I think, to note that there are actually four different types of flooding that we experience here in Jacksonville. We see high tide flooding, coastal storm surge, which is kind of what you'd expect with a hurricane. We also have riverine flooding. So when we have extreme rainfall events that can cause our tributaries to rise. And then we have inland stormwater flooding when you have those rainfall events and it kind of pools in streets and on sidewalks. So when of course, you have moments where multiple types of flooding happen at the same time, and we refer to that as compound flooding. So,
yay.
What happens when you have high tide and then you get a hurricane, or when river levels are already high because of a rainfall event and then the tide comes in? So we have done some comprehensive analysis on storm surge, high tide projections, and riverine events, and then begun to map together a few areas where that compound flooding might happen. That's certainly an area where we're hoping the data and expertise will expand in Florida in the future, and we'll be able to incorporate that in next iterations. But right now, we have the most comprehensive picture we've ever had of where flooding could happen today, but then also where we can expect it in the future with 2.3 feet of sea level rise. And this is going to really inform and guide the way that we do planning for the city of Jacksonville.
And so this data will really be incredibly helpful, but it sounds as though we are facing some serious vulnerabilities in terms of both flooding and heat.
Absolutely. I mean, but I think what's important to remember is that climate's going to be impacting every community in Florida, but also across the country. And I think the important thing is that cities take the steps to measure and understand their risks so that you can help mitigate them. And I think what this data, the other piece that this data is really useful for us is it's not just looking at exposure. I think often when you think of a FEMA flood map, You're thinking of where is water going to go? And we have that data now, but we've also begun a vulnerability analysis on it where we can say not just what might be impacted by a flood, but really how vulnerable would that property owner be? So if you imagine two houses side by side, and one is slab on grade right at ground level, and the other one is elevated 2 or 3 feet up on stilts, and then you imagine a tidal wave coming at it, those two homes are not going to be in the same position of vulnerability. And so we now also have data that shows us on a census block level where the highest percentage of vulnerable properties are in our community. And that's going to allow us to, again, make the best decisions possible to guide our mitigation efforts.
549-2937, where are the most vulnerable parts of town?
Well, it's a great, I mean, I think a lot of people expected, and as I did, that we would see it along the main channels of the St. John's River. And when you're looking at coastal storm surge, that's the case. When I first started, a lot of people would say, well, we know where it flooded during Irma. Let's just put all of our resources there. But what we're seeing is that's not the only place where those same type of conditions could happen. Wind is a huge factor in our hydrologic basin on the St. John's. And so really every edge of the main channel of the St. John's River is something that we would consider highly vulnerable. But what this data also exposed for us is that when you're looking at that inland riverine floodplain flooding, we start to see the impacts of flooding really stretch to every corner of Duval County. So it also helps us realize that we shouldn't just throw all of our resources at solving one problem and leave ourselves blind or exposed to the other parts of the county that might be dealing with flooding. So it really opened our eyes to all of the different communities across Duval County that could be experiencing this type of flooding in the future and that we would need to be focusing on.
What are your concerns about flooding and extreme heat and questions for the city's chief resilience officer, Ann Colianese? Let us know. We'll go to your calls in a bit at 549-2937. You know, I once heard an insurance person on the program say the whole state of Florida is a flood zone, that even if you don't live in a so-called floodplain or flood zone, you should still be buying flood insurance. And it sounds as though you basically agree with that.
Absolutely. That's something that our emergency preparedness team also always says, make sure that you have flood insurance. Most FEMA flood claims are on properties that are outside of their designated regulatory floodplain. So always a good way if you're concerned about your home and your property, flood insurance is a way to kind of protect your assets.
Okay. In a minute, we'll talk about mitigation for all of this, but can we talk about extreme heat for a minute too? Because you've been mapping the heat islands around town with this data gathering. Tell us about the dangers of extreme heat we need to be thinking about for Jacksonville.
Absolutely. This summer, the Curry administration partnered with UNF on a large urban heat mapping exercise. And again, it gets back to exposure versus vulnerability. That study gave us the best picture we had of exposure to extreme heat, what parts of town were hottest. And what we saw is that depending on where you're standing, there could be a 12-degree temperature differential, which is incredibly significant when you're starting to think of the role that heat can play on public health. But we now have also combined that with a number of other data sets to start giving us a picture of how vulnerable different parts of the city are to extreme heat. We've looked at land cover, percent tree canopy, and then pulled in census data that shows us where the highest percentage of residents over 65, under the age of 5, live, and then also pulled in median household income, because we know that plays a role in who has access to air conditioning, who's willing to turn it on and pay that higher bill. And all of those factors impact how vulnerable a person or a community are to the impacts of extreme heat. We now have maps that show that as well.
In a moment, we'll hear how all this data is going to be used to help protect all of us. But first, what are your questions for Ann Colianese, Jacksonville's Chief Resilience Officer? She's the first person to hold that role. 549-2937. Charles on the west side. Go ahead, Charles.
Good morning, Melissa and Ann. I just read disheartening news. You know, it's so timely that you're talking about the different elevations of the houses. I just read about this new suburb called Terrapin Creek they want to develop in the Tumucon Preserve area. They're talking about they're having to build up the houses and elevate them, and that's going to have an impact on the neighbors, I suppose.
Yeah, thanks for that. Have you heard about that?
I'm not familiar with that specific development, but in general, elevation is one way that we look to mitigate these impacts. And part of the way that we've been able to see vulnerability across Jacksonville to flooding and to this new data that we've gathered is looking at when different building standards went into effect. So we currently have a requirement that if you're in the flood zone, your building, your structure is built to a base flood plus 2. So based on the year that went to effect, every structure that was built before that is now on our watch list, making sure that that we're looking at it as potentially a little bit more vulnerable. But it also gives us an opportunity to look at future standards that we might need in areas that are high risk. So elevation is one way that we can do that. Building codes are one way that we can look at improving resilience.
Now, one of the maps you recently shared with City Council shows vacant lands in Jacksonville and their vulnerability. What about all of the open lots and how that factors into your study?
I'm so glad you brought that up. That's one of my favorite data points that we have. Looking at open space gives us both an opportunity to solve a problem, that's an acute problem, but also to prevent future problems. So if you think of vacant land as a way to absorb floodwaters, you can look at that as a potential site for interventions like green infrastructure, living shorelines, other things that we know can absorb water and take pressure off of nearby assets. But also, it's important for us to know where vacant land is most vulnerable to flooding so that we also don't perpetuate the issues that we're seeing by having a lot of development go into areas that maybe aren't flooding now, but that we know in the future would be highly vulnerable.
Yeah. And so that gets into, I would assume, revising building codes, revising ordinances. How does that factor into your vision and what you'll be recommending?
One of the main regulations that we're looking at right now is our land development regulations at the city. That's one of the best tools that we have to prevent the problem that we're facing from getting worse by having development go into areas that will be unsafe in the future. And I think for the regulatory update, we'll be looking at a full suite of regulations. And I think oftentimes people think that that's just meaning mandated regulations, things that developers have to do differently. But we're also going to be taking a deep look at incentive-based regulations and how can we promote the type of future we want to see in Jacksonville and really push our development community to help us achieve those goals.
That, I think, is going to be a pretty heavy lift given the largely free reign the development community has had in this city and this state for a long time. So how do you go about that?
The nice thing about doing this work in Jacksonville is that we have so much open, undeveloped space. Only roughly 40% of the county is currently developed. So we really have a lot of potential to guide this. And there's no shortage of open space for new development. It's about being smart and how we're encouraging that.
Chris in Avondale. Hi, Chris. How are you?
Oh, hi. I was just curious about the dredging of the St. John's River. If we're worried about water mitigation in this town, dredging the St. John's River to me seems as if it's just going to bring further water flow in here, especially with storms, full moons, high tide, nor'easters, and such. Have you addressed that at all?
Thanks for that question.
So the models that we use to develop our flood maps took in the deeper dredged depth of the St. John's River. So the data sets I'm looking at already have that as an assumption. So I don't have a comparison in front of me, but I will say that there are cities all over the country and the world that have deep port channels and are able to find ways to make sure that they're protecting their community. So that's factored into how we're approaching this and involved in already incorporated into the data sets I'm looking at.
Here's an email from Jim. Most of Black Hammock Island is zoned to allow one house per acre to manage flooding concerns, but a current proposal would double that, he says. So a potential rezoning of a place like Black Hammock Island is one example of how this may play out. A developer wants to add nearly 100 homes to that part of town. That, I think, is one specific example we could look at as what will be challenging the city going forward.
Yeah, and I will say that we're in this moment of time where we're still looking at how those kind of comprehensive planning department regulatory updates will look. But in the interim, I'm working with every city department to make sure that they have early access to this data to kind of guide the decisions they're making today, before we have some of those more systemic policy changes in place. So,
and we'll we'll talk about that in a minute, and also how you can come out to some public meetings in February to learn more. But first, let's go to Jeff in San Marco. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, I would like to know, is the city doing any engineering studies on pump systems for households that are on the border of a flood zone? Places where if the city pumps are not working properly, or there's some unusual event that happens, that if there were water incursion in the house, that the pump would take up and start pumping the water out of the house. There are pumps available even from Amazon for less than $1,000 that will pump thousands of gallons a minute. I noticed the people that do the sewer, the utility people have this kind of pump, and it will spray water 2 miles away. It'll spray water a long way. They're multi-thousand gallon per hour pumps for households that might flood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Especially
for
in San Marco, just one of many neighborhoods where people are thinking about these things.
I will say most of the work that that I'm working on is focusing on city systems. So getting into studies of kind of interventions that homeowners can take has not been a part of this planning process yet. I'll also say that, you know, pump stations are one tool in our toolbox. And at least at the kind of municipal scale, they need to be deployed in really specific situations. During a major hurricane, you're never going to be able to pump out the St. John's River from an area until waters start to recede below the bulkhead. We do, however, know that pump stations can be a really great option for some of the new nuisance flooding that we see from extreme high tide events. So I would also just say, you know, there's no one size fits all solution to flooding, and we're looking at deploying the best solution for the type of flooding and the geography that we're looking at.
Catherine in East Arlington. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to point out one of my concerns with, you know, overbuilding, you know, in the Jacksonville area. If we just look at Houston, what happened to Houston in one of the last hurricanes where they were flooded for days because they had not planned out. They had paved over everything and there was nowhere for the water to go. And those kind of things concern me here. Thank
sure.
You.
Yeah. That's great. That's a great point. And we did see that happen. How can we avoid that fate here in Jacksonville?
Well, I think one of the things that's really sets Jacksonville apart is how much city leaders really woke up to the realities of this early. I mean, certainly hurricanes in Matthew and Irma caused damage, but it wasn't a Hurricane Harvey in Houston size disaster. And so that gives us the opportunity to put policy interventions in place, physical infrastructure on the ground, and get ahead of these threats. So really this effort that we've gone under to anticipate our risks and then incorporate that data into our solutions, I think is what's going to make the difference between our city and kind of seeing a disaster like that.
And when you talk about solutions, you're talking about everything from how we regulate land use and development and infrastructure to emergency services.
Mm-hmm.
What else?
Yeah, I mean, I think bringing up emergency service is a great point. One of the really unique parts of this data collection effort is we've been able to run a vulnerability assessment on our roadway network. So we can, most often flood maps will show you what homes are underwater. We can look at what roadways might be inundated, whether that's, you know, a significant length of time or just a temporary inundation at high tide. But then we can also look at all of the homes or all of the facilities that are then cut off from access to the rest of the city. So we're really seeing this as an opportunity not just to guide long-term development, but also to make sure that we're preparing for emergencies, that we're making sure our emergency fleet can get through roadways and access every corner of the county. It can also help us anticipate who we need to call an evacuation order for first if we know that there's a roadway that's going to go out. So really taking this data and applying it across the board to every action that we're making as the city.
Rose emails us, I'm upset. There is so much clear cutting of trees in my neighborhood at Atlantic and Hodges. Thousands of apartments going up and everyone will have at least one car. This area used to be 10 degrees cooler in summer, not anymore. Every day, I see animals die on the roads because their habitat has been destroyed and traffic a slow crawl after 3 p.m. Anna emails us, why not plant a tree at every bus stop in Jacksonville for shade and oxygen? Thanks for that. you know, organizations like Greenscape of Jackson, others are trying to increase the tree canopy to deal with urban heat island problems. But Anne, what about this other email from Rose at Atlantic and Hodges? Seeing overdevelopment exacerbating these problems.
I think
we're all seeing it in Florida. Yeah.
I mean, I think growth is a double-edged sword. I think it's one of the best things about Jacksonville is that we're poised for growth. Mm-hmm. People want to live here. They're moving here. There's a lot of economic prosperity that can come with that. But I think it's also important that that's guided in a smart way. And certainly making sure that we have robust tree cover is not only helpful for combating urban heat island, but also it helps us manage stormwater. And it's beautiful. It's part of having a city that people enjoy living in. So certainly maintaining and increasing our tree canopy is going to be a central part of how we address resilience.
And in reference to the caller that checked in earlier about a certain development, Mark Woods at the Times Union has alerted me to a story in the paper pointing out that the city council could vote next week to approve development of a 97-house subdivision in the heart of a patchwork of nature preserves created to protect Northeast Florida's ecology. And so these are the kinds of conflicts that I think get at the very heart of what you're working on, Anne. This subdivision, Terrapin Creek, has been criticized by the St. John's Riverkeeper and other organizations. Now, you know, you're in an interesting position because you work for the city of Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. How do you work with the city council on these kinds of really controversial local development conflicts that are part of your portfolio? Managing growth, recommending that we plan in a more intelligent way.
The long and the short answer is that my role really focuses on future and focuses on our systems. So individual items that are moving through council right now are being managed by the city departments that have always managed them, the planning department. My role is to take a step back and think, what is not serving us and what will not be serving us in the future and what modifications are going to be needed to avoid the worst impacts long term, making sure that there's kind of a systemic infusion of resilience thinking into whether it's planning, public works, our parks department, neighborhoods. So really the role of a chief resilience officer is to be future thinking. And unfortunately, we can't do that if we're also a rubber stamp in the process of every individual permit that's moving.
Eric downtown. Hi, Eric. Go ahead. Thanks for holding.
Yeah, thanks, Melissa. I wanted to just pick up on exactly where you are in the conversation about planning and permitting. I live downtown. I walk downtown a lot. And I'm real close to the Vistar Memorial Arena and the ballpark. And the new Doro apartment building has been under construction. It looks like it's coming along nicely. Mm-hmm. What's noticeable to me is at high tide, there's a creek that runs directly between the Maxwell House plant and this new development. And for months, there was twice a day, 12 inches of water that the workers had to work around from high tide. Now they've taken to the strategy of pumping out the water while they're working on it. So I'm very tuned in to this idea of the strategic perspective that Anne brings with the kind of tactics of what permitting and planning shortfalls we're facing right now. Mm-hmm. So any further comments about that would be welcome, because this is yet one more example that is obvious to me as a person who walks around downtown.
Yeah, sure.
I think it's an interesting example to look at. For those who aren't familiar, this is the creek in reference is Hogan's Creek.
Hogan's Creek.
And I think, you know, part of it is how our development's going in a smart way. And I will say that there's no area where, you know, flood risk is, you know, makes it off the table to build there. It's about the design. So I think that's one is how are we influencing the design suite of design options used to build a structure in an area that we do know may experience flooding from time to time, making sure that that's not doing costly damage every time it happens. The other thing that can happen at that site, though, is that, you know, we're looking at doing a large restoration project on Hogan's Creek to alleviate some of the flooding that on that tributary. And I think that's another option at our disposal.
Now, you're having three public meetings next month to talk more about all of these issues. People can join?
Yes, we would love to have anyone in the public, everyone who's interested in this topic, come out. They'll be held, all three meetings will be held in February. The first will be Thursday, February 9th at the Legend Center. The next will be Monday, the 13th at the Ed Ball Building. And then finally, Thursday, the 16th at the Southeast Regional Library. All of these public meetings will be at 6 p.m. We'll be able to show you some of the data I referenced. You'll get to see some of our maps, really, really dive into this with us. And then we want to hear from you about what problems you're seeing now, what concerns you, but also what solutions you're excited about. We want to make sure that this final strategy really does reflect what community members want to see in their neighborhood. And we'd love to have you come out.
Come out and meet Chief Resilience Officer Ann Colianese at three different meetings around town next month. And if you go to adaptflorida.org, you can learn more details about Ann's work and the maps illustrating the data the city of Jacksonville has been collecting to make this a more resilient city. And thank you.
Thank you.
And much more still ahead. Later, the Jewish Family and Community Services hosts a special exhibit to honor International Holocaust Remembrance Day. That's later, but up next.
The governor again outlined a very bold initiative to ensure that Everglades restoration is accelerated.
The state funds more work on the Everglades. We'll speak with the CEO of the Everglades Foundation after this. Well, in his inauguration speech recently, the governor said his administration is ushering in a new era in stewardship for Florida's natural resources. He touted $2.5 billion for Everglades restoration and pledged $3.5 billion more. DeSantis has garnered praise from some environmental advocates for channeling more money into the Everglades, while others say he comes up short on environmental concerns. For more, I spoke with Eric Eichenberg, CEO of the Everglades Foundation. So tell us about the governor's second term efforts to continue Everglades restoration efforts. How impactful will they be?
Well, I think it's important, as you point out, that they're being continued. And the announcement that occurred last week on the fourth anniversary of the first executive order, the governor again outlined a very bold initiative to ensure that Everglades restoration is accelerated, that there are resources that he is urging that these dollars be allocated to complete these critical projects. He made it very clear that the future of Florida is linked to our waterways, our Everglades, our drinking supply, and certainly to the economy. So it was a significant announcement in Bonita Springs, and we look forward to working with the legislature to get it done.
And certainly that's the next step. Can you hammer out what will be the specifics of how these funds will be used for Everglades restoration and water resource protection?
Sure. So, for example, listeners may be familiar with the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan. It was passed by Congress, signed by President Clinton back in December of 2000. And here we are now 23 years implementing this plan. And it calls for a variety of above-ground reservoirs and other infrastructure components within the Everglades ecosystem. So from Lake Okeechobee to the east, to the west, certainly south, down through the central Everglades, and ultimately all this goes down to Florida Bay and Everglades National Park. So specifically, the dollars that the governor is asking be committed over the 4 years, a reservoir on the Caloosahatchee River that is critically important. It's about 11,000 acres. It's going to receive water that comes through that local basin runoff, if you will, also some lake water that would go through this reservoir. There's going to be a component to make sure that the phosphorus and nitrogen, the pollution that's in the water, is taken out, so you're delivering clean water into the Caloosahatchee. Similar, south of the lake, right smack in the middle of all these sugarcane fields, another above-ground reservoir is being constructed as we speak, and dollars from the state would be going to support that as well. So that's just two examples of a variety of projects throughout the South Florida Water Management District.
And when we talk about water and nitrogen pollution, let me ask you as a follow-up. In his first week in office, the governor issued an executive order establishing a blue-green algae task force. Water scientists from all over the state working on ways to reduce toxic blue-green algae. They came out with some recommendations in 2019. Only a few of those have been enacted since then, however. What about that effort, and does it need more momentum?
Well, you're right. We do have some challenges as it pertains to water quality. I will also point out that Florida has not met what's called a total maximum daily load of phosphorus entering into Lake Okeechobee from the north. So we have a polluted lake. We have other water bodies that are impaired, man-made challenges, and you know the governor can only do so much. He's called for these commissions. He's taken the politics out of the topic, and he's put on experts who are in this field who are making recommendations, but it ultimately comes down to the Florida legislature. And it is, you know, it's our hope that with new leadership, House, Senate, they can see the challenges that we're describing here, and additional steps can be taken. North of the lake is where all of these hot spots of water pollution are occurring. It's our hope that the new Commissioner of Agriculture can roll up his sleeves, work with the community there, with the Department of Environmental Protection, and let's see some real results on the water quality entering Lake Okeechobee.
Certainly, supporters of the Everglades have hailed this commitment by the governor to further restoration efforts. And at the same time, some environmental groups have accused Governor DeSantis of greenwashing, you know, the idea that he gives lip service to supporting the environment but doesn't necessarily follow through. As CEO of the Everglades Foundation, what's your response to the critics out there?
Well, it's a lot of noise. It's in my view, it's irrelevant. You always have a chattering class that you know, would rather chirp from the sidelines. But be that as it may, we see firsthand. I mean, the governor, you mentioned days into office 4 years ago. I will submit to you the most significant decision, which was a moment in leadership, was firing the governing board of the South Florida Water Management District, who installed 9 men and women who fully understand the governor's vision for Everglades restoration to make sure water is flowing down to the Florida Keys, down to Everglades National Park, leveling the playing field so that Big Sugar is not driving the decisions that were happening under the previous administration. This governor has stood up to that. And what's happened over the last 4 years is we've had the most significant momentum around the Everglades because the business community is engaged, realtors, fishing boat captains, small business owners along the coast who rely upon a tourism-based economy. All of this now is allowing us to see the results of this hard work, and we are as optimistic today that we're going to get there, and it's thanks to leadership that we're seeing out of the governor's mansion.
And when we talk about Florida tourism, let me ask you, whether it's the governor or the legislature or the business community, what about the more existential concerns going beyond the Everglades about the threats posed by a warming planet to our tourism economy in Florida? Should Florida be acting more aggressively on climate?
Well, I would say to you the acceleration or the sense of urgency to ensure that Everglades restoration becomes a reality, because as you redirect water flowing south on the Florida Peninsula, it recharges the aquifer that pushes eastward. So it's not stopping sea level rise or saltwater intrusion, but it's acting as a buffer. It's pushing back against those issues. So as we deal with urbanization and continued growth, we deal with coastal resiliency, you cannot take your eye off the ball of restoring the Everglades because it's all complementary. So by working in a bipartisan way, because this is truly a unifying issue, let's identify the projects, the solutions that not only restore the Everglades, the drinking water for 9.5 million Floridians, let alone all the tourists that come here, but it's also protecting the 21st century economy in this state, which is tourism-based, which does rely upon a robust real estate market. We can do this, and we're seeing those results as we speak.
Eric Eichenberg, he's CEO of the Everglades Foundation. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks again.
Well, this Friday, January 27th, is International Holocaust Remembrance Day, a day to honor the memory of Holocaust victims and encourage Holocaust education worldwide. Jewish Family and Community Services is hosting a special multimedia exhibit this year to mark the occasion. The Cattle Car, Stepping In and Out of Darkness, is an immersive exhibit set inside an exact replica of a World War II cattle car, the type of car that was used to transport Jews and others to concentration camps. Now, the exhibit will be in town for a couple of weeks, and it is open to the public, along with other exhibits, including the cross-state Hate Ends Now tour. Melissa Williams is Holocaust Education Coordinator at Jewish Family and Community Services. Hey, Melissa.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. So tell us a little bit more about this exhibit as we honor International Holocaust Remembrance Day on Friday.
Yes, so the Hate Ends Now tour has been in Jacksonville for the past 2 weeks, and it'll be visiting the JSCS campus on Friday from 8:30 to 3 o'clock. As you said, it's an exact replica of a cattle car that was used to transport Jews to concentration camps. So you get to have a journey walking through a cattle car, and as you're walking through, you get to hear stories from survivors about their real life journey in a cattle car. And I have to tell you, as a bonus, one of the survivors whose stories you'll hear inside the cattle car will be with us on Friday. So as you exit the cattle car, you can debrief with her and ask her any questions. And in addition to that, there will also be a Holocaust artifacts exhibit on display inside our building. And as always, folks are welcome to spend some time in the Frisch Family Holocaust Memorial Gallery. I should also mention that the exhibit is free, but we do recommend registering in advance since we can only accommodate a limited amount of people.
Definitely go to JacksonvilleHolocaustMemorial.com to register. And this is such an important resource, Melissa, the most prominent space of its kind between Atlanta and Orlando. Tell us a little bit more about the gallery and the work of Jewish Family and Community Services.
Sure. So the Frisch Family Holocaust Memorial Gallery is a permanent memorial that is placed in the center of the JSCS building, and we call it the heartbeat of our agency. It was actually created by a local Holocaust survivor. And surrounding the memorial is a yearly rotating art exhibit. So our current art exhibit is called Art in the Holocaust, which contains reproductions of works of art from Yad Vashem. And all of the artwork in our exhibit was created during the Holocaust, so either in camps, ghettos, or in hiding. Some of the artwork acts as a document of the harsh realities that were happening at the time, while some of the artwork depicts a means to escape the harsh realities. And I'll tell you, half of the artists in our exhibit survived the Holocaust while the other half were murdered.
Yeah. Now, Holocaust education. Let's talk about that, particularly since we've seen this rash of hateful anti-Semitic messages displayed all over town. And there's a new fund that's been established through the Jewish Federation of Northeast Florida to improve education about the horrors of the Holocaust. This is so important because future generations might not know this history.
Correct. And, you know, there's been recent studies that show the knowledge of the Holocaust is on the decline. In fact, there was a survey of adults under 40 where 63% did not know that 6 million Jews were murdered during the Holocaust. And in fact, some of the adults had never even heard the word Holocaust. So when we teach about the Holocaust, we're teaching about a time in history that cannot be forgotten. We're teaching about where hate can lead. We're empowering students to recognize when hate is being spewed, even sometimes in subtle ways, and to really look into themselves to decide if they're willing to stand for that. And I can tell you that every student, even every adult who's used our resources, who's visited our gallery, who's participated in a speaking presentation, even more so than learning about the Holocaust, they walk away with a sense of empathy. And in my opinion, there is just nothing more important that we can be teaching.
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at surveys of adults under the age of 40, 63% don't know that 6 million Jews were murdered during the Holocaust. And as you said, some had never even heard the word Holocaust.
Right.
That's incredible.
Right. Right. Well, and I just, you know, I always say the best way to combat hate is through education, and that's where we come in. And so in a nutshell, we offer four main resources. We have the Frisch Family Holocaust Memorial Gallery, which I already told you about. We also have our Holocaust Survivor Speakers Bureau, which is where Holocaust survivors and second generation and now even third generation family members share their stories, which is available for in-person and virtual talks. We also have teaching trunks, which are filled with age-appropriate Florida standards-based lessons, and we offer teacher training throughout the year as well.
Check it out, folks. Visit JacksonvilleHolocaustMemorial.com. Register to come see this free exhibit, part of the Hate Ends Now tour. Melissa Williams, Holocaust Education Coordinator at Jewish Family and Community Services. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And when we come back, from new eateries to new food trends, what's got you hungry this month? We'll check in with Lauren Titus of Edible after this.
No surprise, I think, that borrowing by small businesses is slowing.
I think that is a result of the interest rate increases, inflation, just general uncertainty in the market on the part of businesses and consumers.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, business lenders, and their take on this economy next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6, here on WJCT News 89.9.
A cigarette butt is tiny, but in Spain, it is a huge problem. Hundreds of tons of butts are collected from streets, plazas, and especially those white sandy beaches. Spanish lawmakers want tobacco companies and smokers to pay for the cleanup. There are plans to tax each cigarette, and there are hopes for a recycling program. Spain's problem with cigarette butts, it's next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Robin Young. Willie Mae Brown has a new exhilarating young adult book about how she grew up in Selma, Alabama, in the run-up to the infamous Bloody Sunday March for Voting Rights.
We knew that there was trouble out there, people disappearing and stuff like that. So I have no fear because Selma taught me a lot. It raised me.
My Selma, next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Concern in Washington is growing over TikTok. Congress has banned the app from most U.S. government-issued devices, and at least 22 states have taken similar action. Democratic Representative Raja Krishnamoorthy is leading the effort to go further. Next time on 1A, he lays out why we need a new law to stop the Chinese Communist Party from using TikTok as an easy way to spy on America.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, despite the recent loss of some of the First Coast's most beloved restaurants, plenty of new ones are popping up this year, and Edible Northeast Florida devotes its latest issue to them. It's called Emerging Faces. Editor-in-Chief Lauren Titus is here to tell us who some of these new talents and places are. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, and a delicious new year it is, as we learn when we go inside the latest issue of Edible. What's on your culinary radar this January?
Well, you know, there's so many more opportunities outside of the traditional restaurants that folks who are passionate about working in food and drink are taking the plunge. And despite the pandemic, or maybe because of it, they're going ahead and opening businesses and working and collaborating with others in the area, even in Palatka. An area where you don't necessarily think about innovation and new ideas emerging. We're seeing some exciting things happening down there with a new brewery, an award-winning brewery, Azalea City Brewing, in an old Coca-Cola plant. So it's fun seeing the repurposing of an old building into something shiny and new and luring people over to Putnam County these days.
Very cool, and that's replicated all over town. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're seeing some new flavors emerging in the area. We've got a restaurant over in the San Marco neighborhood, Pink Salt. It's been there a couple of years, but I think that it's finally catching the attention of some folks who live outside of the neighborhood. And Chef Richard over there is serving up some delicious Jamaican flavors with a little bit of Indian seasonings mixed in based on some time he spent with an Indian family living in Atlanta. So it's exciting to be able to walk in our neighborhoods and have a taste of the world right at our fingertips like that.
You know, on the cover of your issue is Ashanti Green and her Green Legacy Farm. I had the opportunity with some friends to go have a farm-to-fork dinner at her farm the other night. And local sustainable agriculture, of course, is a huge thing in town as it is everywhere. And you at Edible have been writing about that for some time. How much is that continuing to grow?
Oh, we're going to see a huge expansion of that. Some of the micro farms are setting up tables at some of the pop-up markets around town, which are also becoming more frequent. But Ashanti is really taking the lead on some of this, not only at her farm up at the Juicy Roots Farm, her collective, but also by working with her mother and opening a storefront in Springfield. So she's really taking that farm to table seriously and putting it on shelves and trying to make fresh seasonal food more accessible to people in the Springfield neighborhood and beyond. And it's really very exciting to see what she's doing. She's also working with Manifest right now. They produced spirits based on the Roselle, the hibiscus that she grows on the farm there, which very exciting to see Roselle getting a moment in the spotlight like that.
Yeah, our own producer Heather Schatz wrote that article in Edible, by the way. And one more trend, more Filipino restaurants. We have a big Filipino community here.
Yeah, very exciting. I found it interesting that in the national food trends, ube is one of the flavors that is going to be gaining some prominence this year. And of course, the folks here on the First Coast know ube very well. We see it in some of the Filipino bakeries. Purple Roots is one of the restaurants that's opened in the past year. And Jojo Hernandez is getting ready to open Abstract Essence, a Filipino brick and mortar restaurant that he did a lot of testing the recipes in his food truck over the past couple of years. So we can't wait to have a chance to sit down at a table and enjoy his food there.
Check it out in this month's issue of Edible Northeast Florida. Delicious details from Lauren Titus, editor-in-chief. And thanks so much for joining us. Happy eating.
Thanks. You too, Melissa.
And thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks also to our fabulous team, David Luckin, Heather Schatz, Brendan Rivers, Isabella Da Silva, Michelle Corum, and you. Drop us a line anytime at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News, 89.9 Jacksonville. Thanks for the company and make it a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.